This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll hear about a report suggesting food banks will continue to struggle throughout 2023. It's the 40th anniversary of Flag Day and the Internet as we know it. We'll hear about important milestones for the net in Cape Breton thanks to CBU's predecessor UCCB and the story of Cape Breton's connection to a mysterious island that could be home to one of the greatest treasures of all time. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Food banks across Canada continue to experience significant challenges due to an increase in demand because of rising inflation rates, with the price of food reaching all-time highs, and 2023 isn't expected to be any better. And there are some people who believe the only solution is paying the ultimate price. Here is a Global News year-end interview with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
I want to ask you about the cost of living, which you raised. Inflation is hovering around 7%. You know, the Bank of Canada has raised interest rates multiple times. It's causing such hardship for people in this country. I want to play you a clip, if you don't mind. We've done multiple stories about the cost of living, and this one in particular surprised a lot of us.
So people are so desperate, they're coming here for food, but then they're asking you about assisted suicide?
Yes.
That's, you're having people ask you
yes.
about assisted suicide?
Yes. That, when I say that this is an emergency in the community, people who are living at the bottom income percentile in our community are talking to us now about taking their own lives because it's too hard to be poor any longer. That's the CEO of the Mississauga Food Bank, and we were stunned by that. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
It's heartbreaking, and it deepens my resolve to do everything I can to be there for people. Inflation is a global phenomenon. It's linked to the war in Ukraine, linked to the disruption of supply chains happened by the pandemic, and it's hitting everyone around the world. The fact that it's hitting Canada slightly less hard than most of our fellow countries isn't even a tiny bit of reassurance to any family who's visiting a food bank for the first time or losing hope like that. And that's why we've had to step up, and we will continue to step up. We've moved forward with targeted supports, doubling the GST supports for 6 months, moving forward on cutting childcare fees in half this year, which is making a huge difference in the lives of a whole bunch of families with young kids who we know are extra vulnerable. We're moving forward with dental care for families that otherwise couldn't afford it or would have to make impossible choices to afford it. We're giving a top-up for low-income renters. We're doing a number of things, and we'll continue to do more. But we know that times are really tough for Canadians, and Canadians, as we saw from all the volunteers at the food banks, are trying to be there for each other, and the governments are working to try and be there for people. And we will make through this because we've been through tough times before, but seeing people lose hope like that is absolutely heartbreaking, and it just deepens my resolve to continue to be stepping up with direct supports for Canadians, with direct help for as many people as we can.
Lynn McCarron is the executive director of United Way Cape Breton. She heard that interview a few days ago, and she says calling it unsettling is an understatement.
Yeah, it's quite depressing to think that people have lost that kind of hope, that they would rather leave this world than just struggle to stay in it. And in my opinion, they're not feeling very supported by their community, by their government, by their nonprofit sector. They're just not feeling supported. And I think back to when I was a child, and the poverty numbers haven't changed significantly. We certainly didn't grow up affluent, but we had a real sense of community where I lived. We had a church and a school within walking distance, and we didn't feel so isolated. When we needed support, we felt we had it. And I don't think people are feeling that same sense of support right now. And, you know, with rising prices of food and shortage of housing, they don't know where to turn to get help. And if they're choosing to leave this world rather than fight to stay in it, we need to do a better job of helping them feel supported and making sure that they have the hope they need in order to be able to continue to struggle through it. It's quite disheartening, actually.
Aside from the comment we heard just a moment ago where the Prime Minister was answering that question with the reporter, you had mentioned earlier, too, of a situation where a gentleman had looked at that solution because of a housing issue. Can you tell me about that, please?
Yeah, there was an interview. This gentleman was losing his rent-controlled housing. It was in Ontario. It wasn't local, but we do have a housing shortage here in Cape Breton as well. And, you know, with the hurricane, a lot of people lost their homes. I mean, literally, there was no way to repair them. And so that made it more of a struggle. Those kinds of things, just recently there was a house fire where 12 people were displaced from their home. And they have no place to go. They're calling and looking for hotels, which are extremely temporary solutions. And we have no long-term solutions. So it's hard for them to know where to turn. It's hard for us to know what to do, to how to support them. And if they're going to turn to assisted suicide as a solution, we're doing it wrong. We need to be better. We need to be stronger together. We need to come together to be able to help find solutions for these folks. You know, they need that hand up, because the handout isn't working. And the handout meaning, you know, we fix the problem in the moment, give them food for the day, give them a hotel for the night. That's not fixing the problem. They need to feel supported and moving forward, and we need to do better at how we coordinate that and how we collaborate to do that for our community, for our people, for our friends, our families, and our neighbors.
Before COVID-19 and before Fiona and before we saw these increase in prices for goods and services, communities were told that there are many there that have to make some very tough choices when it comes to, you know, do I heat my home this month, or do I buy groceries, or do I buy food? Is it safe to say that that's even more of a problem now?
Oh, absolutely. With the increased prices for everything, people are struggling. We get more and more calls. United Way Cape Breton supports and funds organizations, not individuals. We help organizations to help individuals. And we are constantly getting calls and referring them back to 211 because people just don't know where to turn. They don't know what to do. They don't, you know, they've tried a few different avenues that have panned out only temporarily, and they're looking for longer-term help.
And there's been a report that was released to the press just before Christmas where it shouldn't come as a surprise to too many people, but food banks will continue to struggle in 2023, even more than in previous years. So when you hear something like that, what can we do as a community to help alleviate that problem? Or is it possible that we can do that?
Well, I think, you know, food banks were supposed to be a temporary solution just to get people over a hump. And now we're relying on them for ongoing support. And I think, you know, the general public is also struggling with the increases to costs and so forth. You know, I know myself, I have 4 kids. Going to the grocery stores and coming away with $300 worth of groceries doesn't look the same as it did 10 years ago. So how do we look at solutions to be able to support the nonprofit sector so that they can support the individuals that are really struggling and you know, and can't make ends meet? So I guess we have to come up with a better idea. I know that I work with a lot of the nonprofit sector. We're constantly coming up to, and, you know, collaborating and coming up with ideas and ways to be able to make things better. I do have a group of nonprofits that I'm working with now to see if we can come up with something that is a more of a long-term plan, which is great. You know, we've got a lot of smart people running organizations, and they're a little overwhelmed with what they have to do in order to be able to keep the doors open and keep food on the shelves. I think communicating that and making sure that, the you know, doing stories like this and making sure that people who have the resources can share those resources, whether it's a financial commitment or, you know, donating food or donating time, whatever that looks like. But we have to be able to coordinate that for a longer-term solution and make sure that people that are using those food banks can you know, can feel supported, and make sure that the food banks don't feel overwhelmed with the need. We need to support them in a more longer-term way. And there are a lot of people who are very passionate about helping others, and that's why I love my job, because it's bringing those people together. You know, COVID and the hurricane are all very, very traumatic events. But the thing that I love about it is because of that sense of urgency and emergency, people will come together to be innovative and to be collaborative and to be, you know, want to work better to help solve the problem and create a better solution. That's the part that I love. That's the united way, you know. So we have to remain positive. We have to be the leaders that gives the opportunity for hope for the people that we're helping. You know, we can't just join in the doom and gloom and walk away. That's when the thoughts of assisted suicide come into play. That can't be our solution. Our solution has to be way more positive than that. It has to be, you know, opportunistic, and we have to be able to look at what that looks like. What does poverty to possibility look like? It looks like education. It looks like access to resources like transportation, employment opportunities. It looks like, you know, we have a number of food deserts in our community where we don't have access to public transportation or grocery stores. So we have to think about what that means for somebody who doesn't have a car. And, you know, and even so, how do they actually get to the local food banks? How local are they? How far of a commute is it? And, you know, so that adds another layer to, first of all, I have to go to the food bank. And second of all, how am I even going to get there? So we have to be more aware of and maybe more empathetic to what the problems are so we can find better solutions. If it was you and you're in this situation, what would you do? Where would you go? And let's provide those kinds of supports for people who are really struggling and don't know how to find those supports.
And Lynn, when people hear a story like this, do you hope that someone will hear it and it will inspire them to perhaps be creative and join in this United Call?
100%. The thing about United Way is we're trying to bring people together to help us create solutions. So if there's somebody out there listening that, you know, is in university, in a grad school, in an employment opportunity, entrepreneurs tend to be very innovative. If you're an established business owner or you just feel like you have something to contribute, I would 100% love for you to reach out to me and be part of that work that we're doing, that committee that's been established on finding solutions to these kinds of problems. I can use all the help I can get. So if you have an idea, if you have a thought, or if you have a passion for wanting to make this community better and stronger and move people from poverty to possibility, because possibility means moving forward. It doesn't mean assisted suicide. So if you have any way that you think you might want to contribute and you want to be able to be part of a solution, reach out to me and we will make that happen, and that would be great.
Okay, Lynn, and how can people reach you?
So you can call us the old-fashioned way, 902-562-5226, or you can go to our website, www.unitedwaycapebreton.com.
January 2023 marks four decades of the Internet as we know it. Internet veterans are raising a glass to the net, celebrating the 40th anniversary of Flag Day. On that day, the very limited protocol, NCP, was replaced by TCP, or Transmission Control Protocol, as a way of getting reliable streams of data from one computer to another. At that time, there were just over 300 computers on the network. On Dialogue this week, we have an Internet veteran, Daniel McKay of Dalhousie University.
I was involved in Nova Scotia from the very beginning. We had several teams to build the internet, and one of them was a kind of marketing team whose job it was to do some education and to tell people how useful this thing was, to do presentations, and we even created a catalog of the internet in the early 1990s. It was one big thick book that we gave out to people, about 2 or 3 inches thick, and it had everything on the internet on it, all the FTP sites you could go to, a thing called Gopher, and we would give that to people, and we did all kinds of presentations. myself, I was on the team that did all the technical stuff. Within Nova Scotia, we had to locate places all around the province, including Sydney, for people to dial in. Because, of course, at the time, the internet for users was all dial-up. And we had to set up the connections between them. Those were leased lines from the telco. We had to provision routers that are at the end of each of the lines and then monitor the whole thing to make sure it stayed up and to come up with ways to fix it when it didn't. And to have a team, you know, a 7x24 team that did that. So, and I was on that team at Dalhousie University in Halifax in something called the Network Operations Center. That was an exciting time. We were doing stuff that hadn't been done before, literally. There were some pieces of equipment that had never been connected to the internet before, and we said, can we do this? And the answer was, I don't know, but let's find out what happens. You know, it was a very exciting time. So that's my main interest. I'm very much into celebrating anniversaries, and this is a good, this is a perfect time to celebrate. And specifically this year, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but the people who built the internet, you know, were young and middle-aged people in the 1990s, and well, you can do the math.
So you mentioned Sydney there a moment ago, Daniel. What can you tell us about the early days of the internet in Cape Breton, and what was at that time UCCB? How did the local university contribute to this emerging technology?
Yeah, the line, the data line that we were running, that we needed to run from Halifax to Sydney, those were always charged by the mile at the time, and plus the bandwidth, you know, times the bandwidth, and so it would have been an extremely expensive connection. But there already was a line from the UCCB library back to Dalhousie, because the UCCB library used a catalog called Novanet. That was based in Halifax. It was a big shared library, a shared library catalog. There were terminals already in the UCCB library that were connected to back to Halifax with more or less the same kind of line that we had to use for the internet. And so what we did was we proposed that this line be converted to an internet line. It wasn't internet at the time. It was another type of data going over it. And we said more or less to the librarians, hey, look at this. You know, you'll have your connection to the big card catalog, to the big catalog, you know, as you did before, but you also will have access to the rest of the world, and it'll work just as well. Now, the librarians knew very well that it would not work just as well, and they knew that this was a bit of a fib, but they knew that having access to the rest of the world was immensely valuable, and also, I'm sure, this idea that we were going to be giving internet access to you know, to the Sydney area, to everywhere that you could free access, to everywhere that you could dial in free to a phone located at UCCB. You know, there's a philanthropic element there. And so they said, sure, go ahead. And again, we had another one of these moments of we don't know whether this is going to work or not. Let's find out, where we converted all of the terminals that were existing at the UCCB library over to these new internet terminals. Lo and behold, it did work. And so suddenly UCCB got connected to the internet. Everyone within a dialing range got a free connection to the internet, you know, based on their monthly fees. The library, you know, switched over to these new kind of terminals and continued the business they had. So it was an exciting time, and there were some brave people some brave and thoughtful people involved at UCCB at the time.
It's hard to imagine computers now without being able to use them for the internet. But before the internet became available to the average person, what do you have to say, Daniel, about CPUs before this technology? And it makes me think of a campus that was near the waterfront in Sydney, and it was called CompuCollege. And at least by the late 90s, the school did not have the internet. There was a purpose for them, though. It did have pretty solid enrollment numbers, but certainly not the multi-use tool that we know today when it comes to computers.
Well, I've been on the internet for so long that for me, a machine that's not on the internet, it kind of feels dead. It has it's a dead machine. You know, it's not connected to anything. But people were doing all kinds of useful things. You know that your word processor and write stuff and you write documentation and stories, not using the internet. And I'm sure at CompuCollege they were training people for the technical aspects of this. And all the trades of saving files and archiving files and spreadsheets and document management, those are all useful business functions. And here we are 30 years later, and we're only starting now to really be able to trust the cloud to store documents. You know, people are more or less happy to say, okay, my documents and my spreadsheets and my word processor documents, my other things are okay on the internet. But for a long time, all of those things were necessary. And then when the internet did come along, CompuCollege was ready to train people in things like email and file transfers.
What do you have to say about our privacy on the internet? And would it be naive to think that potential employers don't look up our social media pages when we're looking for a job to get a sense of who we are and what interests us and maybe even what our political beliefs are? So when it comes to a digital footprint, will there come a time when that information will become widely available to people like employers, even if it's our search history on the internet? And also, not to mention the people who own the social media platforms, what kind of information are we providing to them?
Well, we're already well into that. People leave behind trails. They create public profiles. And all of this information, journalists do this on a regular basis, and everybody does it on a regular basis. We call it stalking, or when you're snooping on someone and looking at their public information. But it's not really snooping. This is all public information. They're not hacking into anything to get your private information. This is all stuff that you've published. That has happened because we've engaged in this contract, which perhaps not too many people think about, how do you pay for your Facebook and Twitter and TikTok account? Well, you pay for it by giving your information to Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. That's how you pay for it. Steve Jobs said many, many, many years ago, it says, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And so, he wasn't specifically talking about these social media, but we don't know, all the different ways that corporations and, it could be specific countries, intelligence gathering organizations in specific countries. We don't know how they're going to use the data. We can guess that the overt ways that they're doing it is to better target ads at us, to make more useful ads. And so you can see that, if you Google for a particular thing, your ads for that thing on social media, starting an hour later or very shortly later or the next day, your ads will be more focused towards the thing you Googled. So you can see that going on. That's the overt information. It would be easy to get paranoid and say, we can be tracked by anyone. But if that information was just available for a few people who needed to keep their identities protected from corporations or government, that would be one thing. But we're all doing the same thing. The number of people who actually manage to not broadcast leave a trail of their activities on the internet. The people who don't do that are very small in number. Most of us leave a huge, wide swathe of information that anyone can find. And we do that on a regular basis. The more disturbing part is we don't know how that information might be used in the future. We're getting better at processing huge masses of data automatically. Those ads are probably going to get more targeted as time goes on.
It must be hard to crystal ball this, Daniel, but where do you see the internet going 5 or 10 years down the road? What will it look like for the average person?
Well, the exciting thing that we hear from, I think it was Musk not so long ago, is that we would have brain implants that would deliver information directly to our brain. Not sure how that's going to work, but he comes up with a lot of really great, he comes up with a lot of ideas, and some of them actually happen. We're going to continue to get higher speed. One thing that will be really in Nova Scotia actually got high speed like we've been promising since about 1995. We had a promise to do that in a certain number of years so many years ago, and it hasn't happened, and we're doing it again. We can see already that people are totally reliant on this, and that's highlighted when we've had a few quite severe outages. A few months ago, we had an outage of the data connections to the Interac banking system, and Interac went out all across the country, and commerce came to a halt. Perhaps one of the things that'll come out of that is a more reliable network, and the internet's built to be reliable, but you have to spend a little bit more money to get there. So higher speed, and for sure more dependence on it, and more convergence of the delivery of everything in our home, video and audio and text via the internet.
I'd like to go back to what you said a moment ago there about Elon Musk and his vision of having brain implants. And I think it was Musk who said that because of computers and the latest technology, not only will we become more like robots when you talk about the brain implants, but we are already there, part Android. And some people believe that because of our phones and what they are capable of, and because we use them so much, they're always on our person in one way or another. And it's almost like they are an extension of our bodies, making us part robot. What do you think of that discussion?
Well, that's nothing new. And in fact, you could say that that's what makes us human, right? The thing that makes us human is the ability to use tools. And we've done that ever since we've been human. A few hundred years ago, we discovered a way to make our vision better for people who had bad vision. And so there are people who wear glasses, and that's part of their body. And, we developed books that store memories throughout generations. And we developed radio, which lets us talk over, thousands of miles. He's absolutely right, but he's not saying anything new. We've been part Android since we've been human. I myself have a bunch of screws in my foot from where I broke it, and two titanium hips. I'm part Android. So at some point we will be able to very quickly access information, do Googles without sitting at a screen. I don't know how that's going to work. So we'll have, we'll suddenly have this vast augmented memory.
Okay, well, on that very interesting note, Mr. Daniel McKay, thanks very much for sharing your time and what you told us about the 40th anniversary of Flag Day. Appreciate your time very much, Daniel. Hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up again.
That's lovely. Thank you so much.
Oak Island is a privately owned island in Lunenburg County on the south shore of Nova Scotia. It's believed by some that the island is home to a buried treasure worth a fortune, and for more than 200 years, adventurers have been trying to find it. Sandy Campbell of Proof Positive Coins Limited in Bedeck is an expert in rare coins and artifacts, and he was invited there to the set of a reality TV show to offer his opinion on some of the things they uncovered there. Here's Sandy on his experience on the Curse of Oak Island, and he begins talking about how his interest in coins started.
You know, as a kid, you know, when I was probably 10, 11, 12 years old, I developed a bit of an interest in coins in general. And we had a local grocery business in Bedeck, Campbell's Cash Market. And I worked there during the summer. So the first real boom or rush in gold and silver was in the early 70s. And I was literally picking silver coins out of circulation and shipping them off and getting back about, you know, $1.40 on the dollar, you know, 40% return. So that was pretty big money for a 12-year-old kid at the time. And then it just kind of went from there. You know, I graduated high school in 78, was going to university in Halifax that following fall, and because of the way the coin market had evolved, I decided not to go, went back home for a year. Then I went into, the following year, I went to pre-vet medicine in Truro, Agricultural College, and the market completely boomed. And I literally was driving back and forth on the weekends, doing more coin business than schoolwork. And you know, after a year, I realized that my path was probably set, and it wasn't going to be a DVM. It was going to be, you know, chasing rare coins around. So that's sort of it in a nutshell, I guess.
And up to that point, what was your rarest find or most valuable find?
At that point in my career, I probably had, you know, coins worth several hundred dollars. That would have been it, $300 or $400. Nothing major, just, you know, I bought and sold a lot of silver coins and would buy the odd gold coin and hoard them away, and, you know, just, you know, really kind of reinvested my profit into collectible coins. And, you know, 4 or 5 years later, it turned into, yeah, I guess it was probably 82 or 83 when we went full hog into the industry and started doing the national circuit. So from about, you know, 78, 79 to 82, 83, I kind of kicked around locally. Like I said, just reinvesting profits into, you know, holdings. And then, you know, in the early 80s, I decided it was going to be my career.
And fast forward a bit, you get a call from a very popular reality TV show based in Nova Scotia, The Curse of Oak Island. And that's where the world's longest treasure hunt is taking place, going back to the late 1700s. And you were there a few times to offer your opinion on some of their findings for the brothers, Rick and Marty Lagina. And what was that experience like for you?
Well, I've been around a long time. I'm 60 years old, so, you know, we get contacted to do a lot of, you know, sort of crazy things in the industry. You know, we've done things for Parks Canada, for, you know, the Bank of Canada, the Royal Canadian Mint. And we're fairly well known in the industry, you know, basically worldwide in the industry. We're fairly well known. So we get weird calls all the time. So, you know, the initial call was a little bit funny. It was an email and then a phone call. And, you know, there was, you know, obviously demands attached to this. So, again, at a point in my life where, you know, we kind of want easy instead of things that are demanding. But I just had a sense that this might be something that we should pursue, because I had no idea why we were being contacted. You know, this came through, you know, the back door kind of thing. And, you know, I had no idea it was the Curse of Oak Island. But I decided because of what they were demanding, it must have been something that, you know, was a worthwhile endeavor. So we followed up on it. And, you know, once we signed an NDA, then, you know, they basically told us, you know, what was involved. And, you know, from that point on, it became a bit of a venture, obviously. We visited the island probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 times, I guess.
For one of those visits, you evaluated an object. It kind of looked like a knob or a handle for a chest, and they wanted to know if it was made of gold or brass. And can you talk about that visit, and what do you think it was?
They were quite excited about that find, and rightfully so. I mean, it was a fairly, you know, intricate, you know, brass handle off probably some kind of a high-end chest. And you could just tell by the way that the item was made, you know, it was a very thinly made doorknob, which is very unusual for, you know, it would be on something more decorative. And it was quite ornate, although you couldn't really see that in the show, I don't think, that, you know, the intricate detail of the doorknob. So it was a very, you know, it was a very high-end knob that came off, you know, a fairly expensive chest, whether it was a treasure, you know, a treasure chest or, you know, simply a chest of drawers belonging to somebody with a little bit of money, who really knows. But the color threw everybody, you know, on the island off. To me, it was quite obvious. It was brass. It wasn't gold, although it, you know, would fool almost everybody as being gold. You know, depending on the composition, you know, you can get brass, you know, that does look like gold, depending on how much zinc is in the alloy.
How old do you think that item was, or how old do you think that item is, and where did it come from?
I'm guessing it was English, sometime in the 1700s, late 1700s to 1850. It's pretty hard to be definitive. You just have to go, you really go by the way that the piece is made and comparables. And that's all you can really go on. You know, when I saw it on the show, that was the first and only time I saw that item. You know, they sprung it on me on the show. And, you know, so you go on what your knowledge is of that particular item. That's our best guess. And it's probably in that period, you know, late 1700s to mid 1850s.
You talked to local journalist Rose Mary Godin about your visit to Oak Island, and you talked about a Chinese coin, also with a very interesting design. What information were you able to share on that discovery?
Well, the Chinese coin, again, it's something that really excited, you know, the crew and the cast on the island, and rightfully so. It was a cool item. You know, Chinese cash coins were produced for more than 2,000 years. This particular coin, likely, you know, and I couldn't totally identify it because I'd need to do a lot of research, because you'd have to identify, you know, the characters, which were very faint on the coin. But the method of production, the narrow rims, it was probably something 300 BC, 250 BC to, you know, probably 600 AD. You know, it would be hard to really definitively nail it, because there was so much of parts of the coin that were, you know, were worn out, you know, being buried in the ground for who knows how long. But if I had to take a real educated guess, I'm thinking, you know, 600 to 900 AD, which would put it in, I think, the Tang Dynasty. But it could be earlier than that, too. And likely, you know, came on the island as, you know, as a keepsake. I don't think it's part of any treasure. You know, the value of a Chinese cash coin is pretty minimal in terms of spending power. You know, nobody's going to, you know, bury a treasure chest full of Chinese cash coins. You wouldn't have a whole lot of money if you if you filled up a, you know, a cubic yard chest with Chinese cash coins.
Okay, so that would be like someone bearing a chest full of pennies or nickels now?
So a Chinese cash coin, in terms of relative value, 1,000 cash coins is equal to one tael. And the tael would be about 37 grams of silver. You know, and the tael has changed in terms of weighting value. So let's just say, for instance, you know, figure an ounce of silver. So an ounce of silver today is 35 bucks. You're talking 1,000 pieces would be worth $35 in terms of spending power. So much less than a penny. However, you know, 2,000 years ago, a Chinese cash coin would, you know, probably buy you, you know, a day's worth of food.
And about that coin, it had a square hole in it. Why do you think it was designed that way?
Well, it's just the way the coins are made. Chinese cash coins in that period were cast, meaning, you know, that melt, you know, produce bronze, and then they would pour it into what they call a cast couple die. Like, so they'd carve out what you'd call a tree of coins, okay? So you might have 15 carvings on either clay or stone on one side, and then you'd couple it with the other side of the coin. Okay, so you'd have two halves, and you might have 15 pieces in there, all attached, you know, with a vein, which would give you a tree effect when it was, you know, when the thing was poured and then cooled down. So the reason for the square hole is that after these were cast, okay, and they would cool down, you'd have rough edges on each piece, okay? So they'd cut, you know, they'd cut the vein, so you'd have the coin, but they would remain in place, and they could file the edges without them turning if it was a square edge, a square hole. So they could literally file off and make the coin, you know, more presentable and round. Whereas if it was round, you know, you'd be chasing it around in circles, literally. So that was the reasoning for the square hole. Now, later on, they made Chinese cash coins with round holes as well. So you'd have square and round holes as, you know, later on. These coins were produced up until 1912 in the empire. So anything produced from, say, 1750 to 1912, a lot of that stuff would have a round hole. And some of it was struck later on in the 1800s. Some of it, you know, would have been poured technology.
The purpose of that square hole, it had a practical purpose. And did it make it easier to carry the coins by inserting a string and attaching them if you didn't have a pocket available?
Well, you know what? Historically, you know, these things got carried around, you know, on a string, okay? I think more by accident. It wasn't the intent when these, you know, before they had cash coins, they had, you know, knife money, and they had all kinds of different objects that represented, you know, what we call modern-day money. But the hole in general served a great purpose because, you know, for instance, you could put 100 pieces on a, you know, on a string and you'd have 1/10 of a tael. So it would represent, you know, a fairly substantial value at that time, and it made it easier to carry them around for sure. But that was more by accident than anything else.
You mentioned you signed an NDA, or a non-disclosure agreement, so no spoilers, of course, but from your visits there and seeing how their work is unfolding and the coins and artifacts discovered there, are they on to something? What kind of activity took place there over the centuries? And a lot of fans are probably on the edge of their seats waiting for the big discovery there at Oak Island.
Yeah, I mean, I think the show has portrayed a pretty good picture of probably what's happened there. I don't have any doubt there was treasure in that island, okay? Whether it's still there remains to be seen. I mean, I wouldn't discount the treasure not still being there. But, you know, there's parts of the story that haven't been told yet that, you know, I'm a little bit privy to, I guess. But I think, you know, I think it's a real cool story. It's been a great journey for that whole crew. I mean, we've just been a little part of it, not really much, you know, from our end, we're not a significant part of it. We're just telling, you know, a little bit of history on a few of the things that have been found there. But in general, I think, you know, there's more to the story to come. And you know, all I can say is I think, you know, there was a treasure there. And, you know, possibly it's still there. Who put it there? You know, nobody really knows that. But there was substantial evidence, you know, a few hundred years ago that it existed there. And I think they're gonna get to the bottom of this mystery before it's all done.
So a few years ago, local writer Richard Lorway published an article, and I'll just read a bit of it here, where he says, stories of the Myra River are full of pirate legends that go back hundreds of years to the time before the fortress of Louisbourg. And he writes, historic records indicate that Bartholomew Roberts, also known as Black Bart, the most successful captain of the Golden Age of Piracy from 1650 to 1730, once used the Myra as an operating base. And looking at the map, Sandy, Nova Scotia and Cape Breton would make sense geography-wise for a convenient stop on their way to the Americas from Western Europe. And would you be surprised to learn about significant findings here in Cape Breton as something of what's expected in Oak Island, anything along those lines?
Yeah, I think if, you know, we've had some things that have shown up in homes in Atlantic Canada that were put there 200 years ago. You know, so that's a treasure, okay? You know, if you want to relate it to pirates, yeah, the place was full of pirates, the major mode of transport from one world to the other. You know, we had the New World and the Old World, and, you know, there probably were a lot of things that happened that, you know, even history's not going to find out about. But, yeah, Cape Breton, you know, we're one of the, you know, first stopping points in North America if you're coming anywhere from the Old World. So, yeah, I think there was a heavy presence of pirates in, you know, on our island. There's been no folklore as to stuff buried anywhere here, but, you know, there's been, you know, little treasures that have showed up, again, you know, hidden in houses that are a few hundred years old. But in terms of buried treasures, I'm not really aware of any.
And you enjoyed being on the show where you can share your expertise and something you're passionate about, and maybe your involvement will help them eventually find what they're looking for, if anything is there or not.
Well, you know what? I'm passionate about anything that makes our, you know, our home better. And what I mean by that is Nova Scotia. So I was a very willing participant to help any way we could to make it, you know, make the story, you know, go forward and you know, promote our area. And I think everybody in the province should really, you know, at some point take a run down there and see what these folks are doing, because it, you know, they've got a little museum there and they've got, you know, they do some tours on the island. And, you know, this show's syndicated in 82 countries, and it's totally unscripted. It's reality TV, but it's unscripted. Nobody put anything in front of me and said, this is what we want you to say. They're looking for your honest-to-goodness, you know, educated opinion. And from that, they've built, you know, I guess they're in their eighth season. You know, they've built something quite amazing, and even Rick, I've talked to Rick about it. You know, he's just shocked that it ever went this far. They expected a 2 years, you know, series, and they'd be out of there, but, you know, they're already planning next year. So
What are the rules for treasure hunters in discovering artifacts and coins and relics and things like that? When you find something, who does it belong to?
Depends on where it's found. I mean, if you know, if you have a piece of property, you dig down, you know, in that property and, you know, find $1 million worth of gold, well, guess what? You own it. If it's treasure lost at sea, there's all kinds of legal issues. A lot of treasures that have gone down in ships belong to insurance companies, and they belong to the province. So, you know, any treasures that have been found, like the, you know, the Feversham and the, you know, the Atosha, you know, there's a lot that goes into putting that stuff in the market because, quite frankly, the province takes, you know, the lion's share, and they'll allow you to keep some of it, but, you know, they will take it, put whatever they want in museums and, you know, take the proceeds for anything you want to sell and give you back, you know, a percentage. And that's changed over the years. Like, it used to be almost prohibitive. When Alex Storm found the Chimaux, it was a, you know, it, at that time, the province just basically took it all. You know, they left him with a little bit. And since then, you know, things have backed up a bit. And the province is a little more lax with a couple of the other discoveries. So,
and not to get off topic here, but a few years ago, the penny became obsolete. It went out of circulation. What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? There's really two schools of thought when you pull a, you know, a coin out of circulation. You know, the long and short, the penny, it's part of what I do. Okay, you know, we buy and sell rare coins and paper money, and you hate to see anything pulled from circulation, but it's, you know, it costs 1.7 cents for the government to produce a penny. So it didn't make economic sense to continue producing a penny, okay? At the same time, historically, it's proven that when you pull a denomination out, it creates inflation. So, you know, you get rounding at the bottom end, but it does create a tiny bit of inflation in your economy. So, I mean, would I prefer to keep the penny? You know, all things equal, yes, but if the government's paying 1.7 cents to produce it, you know, the short answer is no. Get rid of the penny. And, you know, I mean, there's better places for the government to spend money than subsidizing a coin to the tune of, you know, almost its full value.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.